as big an achievement and as important a day as it was yesterday for El Salvador, there's still a second piece, which is justice for his killers. And to this point, other than the civil lawsuit that I was involved in the United States against one of his killers, nobody has been held accountable for his killing, and no one has gone to jail in El Salvador or even been put on trial there. So there's the second, as important as the canonization was, there's now the second piece that has to be achieved after all these years.
We're going to do part two of this discussion posted at web exclusives at democracynow.org. So Matt Eisenbrandt, please stay with us, author of Assassination of a Saint. I'll be speaking at the Metrograph Theater in New York tonight and in Florida, in Gainesville, as well as other places this weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
The time is 5 p.m., and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. FM. Up next is the evening news. This KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listeners, members, and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a security vulnerability at a state agency has exposed the personal information of some Oregonians.
The Mental Health Association of Portland hosted a conference on supportive housing today.
And we'll hear a report from a protest in Portland last week outside of an event that detractors say is trying to pinkwash the Israeli military.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 15th, 2018. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Ken Jones. Snake River Correctional Institution, Oregon's largest and most remote prison, was placed on lockdown this weekend. According to a press release from the Oregon Department of Corrections, an inmate assaulted a guard at around 10:30 on Saturday morning. Seven other guards responded to the incident, and all eight were apparently hospitalized for evaluation afterwards. All have been released. The inmate was placed in, quote, segregation. While the press release and media reports do not elaborate further, administrative segregation is a common euphemism for solitary confinement. During lockdown, all visits and inmate activities were canceled. No follow-up information has been released, but KBOO reached out to both the DOC and Snake River for further information. According to the DOC's communications office, Snake River is no longer on lockdown. However, according to an automated message at Snake River's main number, the prison is on modified operations, meaning inmates have no access to telephones, but visits are allowed. No information is available on the identity or status of the inmate now in solitary confinement.
Last Thursday, on October 11th, protests against the pinkwashing of the Israeli military took place outside a downtown Portland building. Here is Layla Kanan with more.
Okay, we'll get that audio for you in a minute, but I've got another story while we wait. In a move responding to Mayor Ted Wheeler's comments during his monthly press briefing on Friday, Vancouver resident Joey Gibson's group, Patriot Prayer, took to the streets on Saturday. They said they were here to protest the Portland Police Bureau's response to last week's protest against the police killing of Patrick Kimmons, during which protesters shut down local streets. Wheeler commented Friday that the situation police find themselves in when responding to protests is one of balance, looking for what could be termed the Goldilocks zone, where police response is neither too harsh nor too soft. To Patriot Prayer, PBB's response to last week's protesters was not harsh enough. Despite the attempt to keep Patriot Prayer's plans under wraps, local anti-fascist counter-protesters were alerted to the march and quickly organized a counter-protest, which yet again led to violence and put Portland police in the middle of yet another political squabble on the streets. Riot cops eventually responded to a melee outside of Kelly's Olympian in downtown Portland by charging into the crowd, waving batons, and firing what Portland police termed less lethal ammunition.
And now we go to KBOO's Layla Kanan with audio from last Thursday, October 11th, at protests against the pinkwashing of the Israeli military outside a downtown Portland building.
On Thursday, I went to the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education to interview people protesting Israeli pinkwashing, which is essentially a deliberate strategy to conceal the continuing violations of Palestinians' human rights behind an image of modernity signified by Israeli gay life. The first interview I conducted was with the organizer of the protest, Olivia. I asked Olivia what they were protesting.
Well, we're protesting pinkwashing, which is a concept that basically suggests that the expansion of the military-industrial complex with more diverse candidates for torture and militarism and, you know, all sorts of violence is not actually radical. And I know that's kind of jargony, so what I'm going to translate that to say is we don't need gay and trans Israeli soldiers killing more Palestinians. That's not radical to us. And we think that both parties deserve a better representation, especially on National Coming Out Day.
This specific event at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education was put on in honor of National Coming Out Day, which coincided with the visit of the first transgender officer in the Israeli Defense Force, Shachar Erez. Here's Olivia again.
Honestly, I don't even know his name. I just hate him. I know that sounds really awful, but I don't care who he is. I just know that he's trans and that he is in the military. And those two things on National Coming Out Day at this Oregon Jewish History Museum don't represent something positive to us. That's not representing the trans community positively. It's not representing the LGBTQ community positively. It's not representing Palestinians who are suffering under the hands of trans people in the military properly, and none of us want that. That stain on our community. We want something better. Hey, we've got some flyers if you'd like.
Olivia was very clever when talking with people attending the event. She had printed out flyers and was handing them out to attendees by saying they were brochures for the event, but not everyone reacted positively.
Hi, would you like a program today?
Thanks.
Oh, yeah. Program. Well, it is now.
The man took the flyer, but after realizing it wasn't a brochure for the event, he tried giving it back to Olivia.
I mean, I'm not a trash bag. You can take that elsewhere, buddy. Why don't you litter, just like the rest of the Israeli military? Oh my God, I got called a
As you can hear, the man called Olivia an offensive name. And unfortunately, our protests were met with other hostilities similar to this one. At one point, Olivia was standing in front of the door to the building, blocking the way in, and a woman kicked Olivia. I hadn't interviewed Olivia about this incident, but when speaking with her, she seemed relatively unfazed by it.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. Shalaikum salam.
Another person I interviewed, whose name I didn't catch, is a part of both the Jewish and the queer community. I thought she would be a good person to talk to because she is representative of multiple minorities, also while protesting for the rights of another, often silenced group. I asked her, if she had the opportunity to talk to an attendee, what would she say?
I would ask them why they thought this was okay, number one, but number two, to actually talk to queer and trans Jews who live in the city, or also queer and trans Palestinians and who are anti-Zionist Jews, and like, why are you guys protesting? Why are you out here? Why do you have flyers? What's in your letter that you wrote us? And like, really actually kind of understand like why pinkwashing is so morally wrong to queer and trans people who are against any sort of anti-occupation, anti-racist, anti-xenophobic, right, anti-apartheid work. Like, I wonder why these people are out here doing this work. I should probably listen. Listening with an open heart is not that hard. So it should take a decent human being to understand why we're out here. You shouldn't have to beg people to see your humanity. So, and you shouldn't tokenize also the trans community for one trans IDF soldier. I forget what he served, but it doesn't matter.
The last interview I conducted was with Chris.
I'm Palestinian and GLBTQ.
Chris and I were the only two Palestinians at this protest, so I thought getting his input would be crucial for understanding the importance of protesting Israeli pinkwashing.
You know, I'm familiar with what a wider bridge, which is the power that's putting on the event, and they misrepresent Israel's relationship with the Palestinian GLBT community by mainly claiming they're inclusive when, in fact, they are legitimizing the apartheid and the fact the Palestinian community, particularly GLBT community, is victim of the apartheid state as much as any straight Palestinian would be.
Those were the voices of protesters at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education, protesting Israeli pinkwashing at the event organized by A Wider Bridge, who hosted Israel's first transgender officer. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, I'm Leila Kanon.
The growing list of violent political confrontations in Portland may start sounding familiar, but one thing that has changed is the way the Portland Police Bureau, or PPB, explains itself afterwards. I have this analysis from earlier today. The Portland Police Bureau's public relations response in the immediate aftermath of Saturday's demonstrations shows a marked change from last year. As far back as July 4th, when Patriot Prayer and counter-protesters engaged in sometimes violent demonstrations, PPB's press releases have been more upfront than usual about the Bureau's strategic goals, tactical decisions, and weaponry during these events. This may be in response to the increased scrutiny of PPB officers' behavior at protest events both large and small over the past few years. PPB's behavior has ranged from their controversial uses of force at an event on August 4th of this year, including allegedly firing a flashbang grenade point-blank into anti-fascist protesters, to a similar event in August of 2017, a year before, in Waterfront Park. At that event, this KBOO reporter watched as a single police sergeant monitored a brawl involving perhaps 200 people, as they fought up and down the riverfront, sending cyclists, picnickers, and tourists scattering. The greater depth of information contained in PPB's after-the-fact press releases includes lengthy quotes from Chief Danielle Outlaw, links to the particular riot control ammunition used, explanations of permitting processes for marches and rallies, and links to relevant Bureau directives on crowd control and incident reporting. However, the changes do not seem to only be in response to community pressure around brutality and lack of transparency. The press releases also increasingly contain calls for people to contact police to report crimes they may have witnessed at the protests or report people they may recognize from videos of the events. They also contain statements and restatements of the Bureau's commitment to law and order. This could be a response to the increased national profile of the Bureau in conservative media, where it has become a poster organization for the perception of Portland as a lawless, riot-prone cesspool of leftist ideology and action. Add to that the pressure from a growing pile of civil lawsuits taking the Bureau to task for using excessive force against protesters. In conclusion, the new seemingly open stance the Bureau is taking towards scrutiny of its crowd control tactics gives us a portrait of an organization trying to placate intractable critics on both the right and left. All this comes as the Bureau is watching the formation of a new civilian oversight committee and taking steps to develop a 5-year strategic plan to move forward a stated commitment to quote-unquote community policing. All of these moves toward transparency leave a big question open to interpretation, however. When the next inevitable showdown between political factions hits the streets, which direction will the cops be aiming? For KBOO Evening News in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
A so-called security vulnerability was discovered last week at the Oregon Department of State Lands, or DSL. The vulnerability was found on October 8th during a routine security sweep, and the system was taken down the same day. According to a press release from the state of Oregon, a forensic investigation by the Enterprise Security Office found that outside parties may have obtained personal information including birth dates, addresses, names, and social security numbers. The state says it will contact everyone whose information was compromised. The DSL administers just under 750,000 acres of land in Oregon, which it leases to various interests, depositing the profits in the state's Common School Fund. KABU reached out to the DSL by phone and email to ask what the compromise system was used for and whether members of the public are among those whose information was accessed. A response we received shortly before airtime says that yes, members of the public who created an account on the DSL website to save unclaimed property or make a claim may have had their information accessed by a third party. The state will be contacting those affected directly and offering free credit screening.
The Mental Health Association of Portland hosted the Oregon Housing Conference on Supportive Housing in Portland today. Supportive housing is housing for people with mental illness or addiction. KABU's Joe Meyer attended the event and filed this report.
Getting people with mental illness or addiction into stable housing saves taxpayers about $15,000 per person per year in direct costs. It's also purportedly good for our humanity. The Mental Health Association of Portland coordinated the Oregon Conference on Supportive Housing today in Portland. Federal Representatives Bonamici and Blumenauer gave the welcoming remarks. During a break, I asked Blumenauer about the decline of federal support for housing over his tenure.
The resources that have been devoted to housing have been declining. And this is going back to the Reagan administration. It's been kind of a goal in Congress to be able to cut. They don't think housing is a priority. And it's been extraordinarily frustrating because the needs continue to accelerate and the resources decline.
Is the solution then more corporate?
I think the solution is to place an appropriate priority on housing.
Also, I have you saying we're paying enough, just not to the right people.
Well, I think the total cost that of failure of people that fall off the wagon, people who have health problems, people who have behavioral problems, people get in trouble with the law, people who get their mental health behind bars. I truly believe that if we looked at all the costs that are associated with failure, and if we were able to put it in on the front end to avoid having people fall over the edge or be able to provide more assistance for the reference I made to wraparound health, the savings just in terms of health care for people who are discharged to supportive housing would almost pay for the housing. So, I mean, we need to take a hard look at that equation.
Yeah, since the government or the citizens are ultimately responsible, do you think then the citizens want to take a more active role in housing?
Well, I think they are taking a more active role in housing, but I think this is a conversation we need to have more broadly because a lot of people don't think it's their problem or don't see the connections. And I think candid discussion here where people talk about the cost of failure might help us reset.
That was U.S. Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer, who is currently running for re-election. We'll hear from his opponent, Mark Kohler, in a few minutes. Following the opening at today's Conference on Supportive Housing, a report from the Oregon State Legislature was presented panel style. After their presentation, KABU asked the first question.
Hi, I'm Joel Meyer with KABU News. Blumenauer just mentioned that the federal government's been in retreat on housing for as long as he's been there. You know, if the people of a municipality are concerned about housing, why don't they take direct responsibility for it and build and own the housing?
State Rep. Ron Noble answered first.
And I'm a proponent of public-private partnerships. I think the congressman made a good point. If we rely on one funding stream, I'd say our current political environment, to jump right into there, we end up with the short end of the stick sometimes. And I think it's going to take private money and nonprofits. It's going to take some municipal money. I believe that government is closest to you at the local level. If the city of Portland goes out of business, you can't flush your toilets. That's a big problem. But county money, state money, and federal money. I think it's got to be a team effort.
Representative Kenny Geyer added this.
I'll just add on to that so you can see that there was a very bipartisan approach to this. I think you're referring to 102, probably, the change in the Constitution that would allow more flexible funding for affordable housing. Because right now what the Constitution says is for any municipal bonding funding public projects. This was done in the Constitution in 1859, and it was mainly meant for highways and fire stations and things like that that obviously the government would own. Government was not in the business of providing affordable housing 150 years ago, and we're now in a very different place.
During a break at the Conference on Supportive Housing, I spoke with a local housing CEO. I'm asking everyone the same question. Why do we need public-private partnerships? If the citizens of the country or city have responsibility towards their fellow citizens, why are corporations involved at all?
Why do we need public-private partnerships?
To solve affordable housing or supportive housing problems.
Well, so I'm with Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit housing developer, housing owner of affordable housing. From our perspective, we get so much more done by leveraging other resources that the public sector can't leverage. So we're able to bring in foundation money, tax credit money, all sorts of other resources that if just left alone by the public sector, they wouldn't be able to pull it off.
Someone would say, well, the reason that the government doesn't have enough money is corporations aren't paying their fair share in taxes. So why is the solution to turn to corporations for our housing problems?
Well, again, we're nonprofit, private sector corporations, and that's the key. We're different than the private developers.
Is there a way to look at a not-for-profit and say, this one is doing good, this one's sort of in it for themselves?
You bet. It's all online. If a nonprofit doesn't have their financials put up on their website, you might question them.
Okay. What about a CEO who may give to candidates? Is that crossing the line?
I don't believe, you know, I think that as nonprofits, it's okay to support initiatives and individuals who align with our mission.
Mark Kohler is challenging Earl Blumenauer for a U.S. representative of Oregon's 3rd District. I asked him about the value of a public-private partnerships.
It comes down to community involvement. I know that there are a lot of people, like you said, who do not trust those big nonprofits, you know, that are really, you know, huge salaries, lots of staff, but how much do they really deliver into the community? Where are these smaller community-based organization nonprofits that are springing up on all kinds of issues, not just on housing issues, but that's really where you have the activism. That's where you really have the ability to get done what really needs to be done, not just what looks politically expedient to some of the, you know, the people in power. And you can tell I'm not a really big fan of a lot of the city, state, county, and even federal organizations in terms of how much of the revenue that they spend actually gets down to the point where it benefits the people it's supposed to benefit them. I've also stated publicly that I'm not going to take corporate or PAC contributions. And so, you know, it's money, of course, is a huge issue if you want to talk about it. But I knew what I would be able to do on my own, and that's what I was prepared to do when I started. I did receive probably about $1,500 total in small contributions, $5, $10, $15 from people I've met along the way who wanted to help. What I try to say to people when they first load, they say to me is, you know, why would you run against a Democrat? Because we need Democrats, because we have to take back the House. And there's a whole issue of, you know, this whole, is just blue enough, you know? I think they really need to have a choice to look and, you know, to vote for someone. We don't have a Republican that's going to run here of any consequence. So there's no danger of splitting the vote. That's going to be one of the big things people worry about is if you vote for an alternative candidate, you're going to somehow open the door for a Trump-type Republican. Well, we don't have that opportunity here. That isn't going to happen. What they do have is the opportunity to make their vote count for someone who really represents them. Earl has done his whole life as a public servant, and I commend him for doing what he's done over the course of his life, but he's not in touch with the people. He is a corporate Democrat in the Pelosi mold. You know, he voted for Hillary. He did not support Bernie. This county, this district overwhelmingly supported Bernie, and yet, you know, Earl didn't do that, and he doesn't do that. He supports the people who support him, and those are corporations and big money, and he has no accountability because he doesn't have any competition. So, you know, like you said, you know, he doesn't run. He won't run. He won't debate. You know, and he's just, everyone considers, you know, it's a waste of time. person when he is automatically going to win? Well, I don't think so. You know, there's a lot of people who are dissatisfied with, you know, what has he done in 22 years in Congress? What can you look at in our district and say that he was responsible for? Yeah, he renamed the post office. You know, that's great. And he has been very strong on marijuana reform, and that's good too. But that's, you know, but as far as for the people of this district, what can he point to and say, what has he really done? What does he fight for? You know, and I think it's just a chance for people to say, I want a choice. I want a, you know, an opportunity to vote for someone who really cares about this neighborhood. I live on Social Security. You know, I don't have $10 million in the bank like he does. You know, I'm one of them, and I think that's the opportunity people have here. And that's, you know, that's the one thing I would say to people is think about your, you know, your choice between more of the same or someone who's really going to be committed to making the changes happen for the people here that really want those kinds of changes.
That was Mark Kohler, the challenger to incumbent Earl Blumenauer's 3rd District House seat. Mr. Kohler spent $10,000 of his own money and raised another $1,500 in small donations. According to the website Open Secrets, Mr. Blumenauer has raised just over $1 million to keep his seat. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kai Emmons, author of the new novel, Weather Woman. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will see a high of 75 and low of 47 with no rain. Today in history, scientists at the University of Utah observed the so-called Oh My God particle in 1991. It's the highest energy, ultra-high energy cosmic ray ever observed by human beings. The quote of the day is from Orson Welles, who said, "The enemy of art is the absence of limitations."
Paul Allen, Portland Trailblazer and Seattle Seahawk owner and co-founder of Microsoft, died earlier today of complications from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. In addition to Microsoft and his sports teams, Allen actively promoted brain research and space exploration, and his company, Vulcan Capital, is a major investor and real estate firm. Forbes valued Allen's fortune at $20.3 billion, making him one of the world's richest people. The magazine also credits him with total charitable contributions of $2 billion, including $500 million to the Allen Institute for Brain Science, contributions to address ocean health and homelessness, and financial support for libraries, museums, AIDS research, and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland. Allen co-founded Microsoft with Bill Gates in 1975, first in New Mexico and then moving on to Seattle. He left the company in 1983, shortly after he was first diagnosed with cancer. Allen was 65.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest. On today's episode, they cover the ongoing fallout of the murder of a Washington Post columnist in Turkey, the beginning of the Medicare open enrollment period, and the struggle to turn out the vote in two very different states.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, October the 15th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Is the moral integrity of the U.S. at stake in the apparent murder of a Washington Post journalist? Also on the Monday rundown, a pair of reports as we head toward the midterm elections in November. Plus, if you're enrolling in Medicare today, help is on the way. First, here's our top story. Senator Marco Rubio said the U.S. moral integrity is undercut if its leaders do not criticize allies that they commit human rights violations. AOL reports Rubio was specifically referring to the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That happened during an interview with NBC's Chuck Todd on Meet the Press. AOL notes that Khashoggi was a vocal critic of the Saudi crown prince. He disappeared over a week ago after entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and there's widespread speculation he may have been murdered. This year's elections will be the first in which all of Utah's 29 counties offer Election Day registration at the polls. Catherine Davis Young reports advocates for the system are hoping for a smooth rollout.
If you show up to your polling place on November 6th and find your voter registration information is out of date or you haven't previously registered, you should be able to take care of it on the spot. Jason Stevenson with the ACLU of Utah says this is an important change, since Utah's rate of voter participation has been low compared to that of other states in recent elections.
That's because there's a lot of barriers to people getting out and voting. People's lives are complex. People move. People are deployed overseas. People even move within their neighborhood and they can end up in a different precinct and all of a sudden find that their names are off the voter roll.
A 2017 report from Nonprofit Vote and the U.S. Elections Project shows states that offer Election Day registration tend to see higher voter turnout. Stevenson is optimistic that that can happen in Utah if the program is rolled out effectively. An ACLU survey of county clerks' offices found not all were prepared for the new system.
With just 3 weeks until Election Day, advocates say there's still plenty of time for counties to promote voter education, train poll workers, and update their websites. Meantime, Tennessee is ranked 50th in the country in voter turnout, but that may change during the upcoming midterms. Here's Stephanie Carson to explain why.
The pursuit of clean energy is what drives groups such as the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. But this election season, the Alliance is working with dozens of volunteers across Tennessee to get out the vote. The group registered people across Tennessee and now has its sights set on turning folks out at the polls. Michael McMiller is a regional organizer in Memphis.
It can't be a half-hearted pursuit in order to make real change. We need everybody, all hands up there. You can't complain about the results of the game if you don't check in at all.
Almost 38,000 people registered to vote on the deadline day alone last Tuesday, due in part to the boost from celebrity Taylor Swift weighing in on the midterms. The Alliance and its grassroots campaign, Renew Tennessee, will now plan 7 Election Day parties at polling stations across the state in an effort to increase voter turnout.
Tennessee also ranks 40th in voter registration. ABC 13 in Florida reports 4 days after Hurricane Michael pulverized the Florida Panhandle, officials in Mexico Beach, which was one of the communities hit hardest, told ABC News 46 people remain unaccounted for. Nearly 300 people, including 10 children, rode out the storm when it made landfall in the middle of last week. That's according to the town city clerk and mayor. And the expiration of the Farm Bill is putting the brakes on conservation programs important for many Illinois farmers and ranchers, Mary Sherman reports.
While the legislation largely stalled over the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the people who grow food and livestock also were impacted. Ryan Stockwell with the National Wildlife Federation says farmers like him currently are unable to apply for the Conservation Stewardship Program, which helps protect natural resources while improving profitability.
And in these economic times and the way that the commodity prices are for farmers right now, that's a really important program to have. But because of the expiration, farmers looking to sign up for that program are not able to do so. That just adds another challenge for farmers.
Stockwell adds that the Farm Bill gives farmers and ranchers the tools they need to protect waterways, support habitat and wildlife, and secure agricultural land for the next generation.
And finally, Andrea Sears tells us today is the first day of the open enrollment period for Medicare, and there's help for anyone signing up for the first time or making changes.
With mailboxes filled with ads for prescription drug plans and supplemental coverage, picking the right Medicare plans can be confusing, but it doesn't have to be. AARP New Hampshire is offering a free 2-part webinar this week to help answer questions about which options are right for you. Todd Fahey, State Director for AARP, says choosing the right plans can make a big difference.
The webinar will help people make informed decisions, including when they should take this, maybe why they should take it, and help them navigate the complexities of this. It is not a simple process, and it will require a bit of work.
Fahey adds it's important to remember you've been paying for Medicare your entire working life through federal payroll deductions, so once you are eligible, he says it makes sense for you to enroll. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week, Newsin and Cruisin', with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Do you live in Clark County? Are you upset with airplane noise over your home and place of business? Do you love airplane noise? Do you want just more? The Port of Portland happens to be looking for one citizen of Clark County to join the 15-member Citizen Noise Advisory Committee, or CNAC. CNAC is the official forum for the public to address its concerns about noise pollution from aircraft. It has a primarily advisory role with no explicit power to affect public policy beyond making recommendations. One of the sources of noise of most concern to residents, at least in upper northeast neighborhoods, is the use of a specific kind of landing maneuver by military jets at the Oregon Air National Guard base, located next to PDX on port property. The jets descend in a corkscrew pattern, which makes for better evasive action than a regular straight-line landing if you are in a war zone, but makes for prolonged, unhealthy noise levels in Portland's peacetime residential neighborhoods. That's the position of Andrew Pritchard, a community activist in the Cully neighborhood who is fighting the guards' practice, and explained the frustrating citizen complaint process to KBOO last month.
Office of Noise Management is another thing in the city, and this is, now you're starting to understand the alphabet soup. Yeah. And the interesting thing, Office of Noise Management in Portland, if you ask what they have to say about it, they don't have jurisdiction over anything that's off the ground. So they actually have nothing to say about this officially, that it's like, that's not our territory. And then it's one of those things, if you talk to the Port of Portland, they say, well, you got to talk to the guard. If you talk to the guard, you say, you got to talk to the FAA. If you talk to the FAA, you say, oh, you got to talk to the Port of Portland.
And by talk to the Port of Portland, they mean bring your story to the Citizens Noise Advisory Committee. Interested citizens of Clark County can apply to be on that committee via the website of the Clark County Council.
The North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce hosted a forum today for candidates from Oregon's 5th Congressional District. The 5th Congressional District Candidate Forum was moderated by former State Representative Patrick Sheehan. The 5th District is currently represented by Democrat Kurt Schrader, seeking his 6th congressional term. Schrader focused on his record in Congress and his years of experience. Republican challenger Mark Callahan focused on his commitment to veterans and issues where he would break with Schrader. Pacific Green Party candidate Marvin Sandis, firm in his belief that he cannot win the election, made a point to put the focus squarely on the shoulders of voters. What we need, said Sandis, is citizen participation.
The Oregonian editorial staff announced this week they've endorsed Newt Bueller for governor of Oregon in next month's midterm elections. The Oregonian editorial staff believe the key issues in this race for governor are affordable housing, K-12 education, and Oregon's broken pension system. Citing little action from Kate Brown in her nearly 4 years as governor and the insufficient experience of independent candidate Patrick Starnes, the Oregonian feels that Bueller is the candidate willing to take action against entrenched issues, despite his ties to the Republican Party and the Trump administration. Jim Moore, a professor of politics at Pacific University who spoke to KGW, says that since the O has not had statewide impact for many years and Portland is unlikely to go red, the impact of the endorsement will largely depend on whether Bueller uses it in his ads across the state. A poll by both KGW and the Oregonian last week showed Brown with an unstable 4-point lead over Bueller.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. The lead story today is an update on a long-running spat between the president and a sitting U.S. senator.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren released the results of a DNA test that suggests some Native heritage as far as 10 generations back. In an edited campaign video released Monday, Warren is seen consulting with Stanford genetics professor Carlos Bustamante, who is also an advisor with the commercial DNA companies 23andMe and Ancestry.com. The tape references Warren's ongoing debate with President Donald Trump, who frequently derides her earlier claim of Native heritage.
In the senator's genome, we did find 5 segments of Native American ancestry with very high confidence, where we believe the error rate is less than 1 in 1,000.
Now, the president likes to call my mom a liar. What do the facts say?
The facts suggest that you
absolutely have a Native American ancestor in your pedigree.
Trump has frequently referred to Warren derisively as Pocahontas. The dispute stems from Warren formally notifying 2 universities after she was hired in the 1980s that she had Native heritage. The video includes statements from people who had a role in her hiring, saying Warren's heritage was not a factor. Warren reiterates she is not an enrolled member of any tribe. The video includes excerpts of Trump at one of his rallies suggesting he'd pay $1 million to a charity if a DNA test showed Warren is Native. Warren issued a tweet saying the president can send the check to the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center. Trump has since backed off of that claim. The National Indian Education Association concluded its annual convention over the weekend, choosing a new president and three new board members. Robin Butterfield, a citizen of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska, will take over as president. Butterfield, also from the White Earth Band of Chippewa, succeeds Jolene Bowman. The nonprofit MoFi helps leverage tax credits to fund rural community projects in low-income areas around the Rocky Mountain region. And now they're helping to open a 24-hour child care center and expand a health clinic for the Northern Arapaho Tribe. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
When the Northern Arapaho Tribe conducted a survey of casino workers, they found a serious need for affordable child care. That's according to the Northern Arapaho Tribal Housing Authority Director, Patrick Goggles.
And that need came back that it was a priority of many of the tribal employees because they wanted to continue to work. Some couldn't work because there wasn't child care service available for them.
So now the tribe is building a 13,000-square-foot child care center next door to the tribe's casino. It can hold up to 300 children from infants to school age and will be available to tribal families 24 hours a day. Goggle says around-the-clock care is a need for a couple of reasons.
24-hour aspect is to help social services place children that are in need of shelter for a short period of time. There are also graveyard shifts at the casino where working mothers, working families need that type of secure, friendly service that they know the people that work there.
The new center will cost about $4.5 million and should be up and running within the year. A remodeled and expanded health clinic will also be completed soon. It'll offer integrated services with a full-time dentist, optometrist, and a pediatrician. That's important since infant mortality on Wind River Reservation is more than twice the rate of non-natives in Wyoming. MoFi President David Glazer says the clinic will also expand its hours into evenings and weekends.
This is a really big deal to keep people from traveling long distances, particularly in the winter, to get basic health care.
The clinic will also hire a full-time therapist to help with drug and alcohol addiction and historical trauma issues. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
And I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Monday, October 15th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Joe Meyer, Layla Kanan, Ethan Rogers, and Ken Jones. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Ken Jones. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's tomorrow morning on KABU. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, an alternative radio author and activist Eric Holt Jimenez outlines strategies to push back against the corporate food regime. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio features the U.S. premiere of Hurl as the season opener of the Carib Theater. At 11:30, Art Focus talks to artists, curators, and critics. All of these KABU programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Sam. Good night, Danielle.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
There's a famous quote attributed to Mark Twain, "Everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." But what if you wake up one morning and find that you have the power to actually do something about it? That's the premise of Kai Emmons' new novel, Weather Woman, published by Red Hen Press. Kai's a fiction writer, playwright, and screenwriter whose previous novels include The Stylist and His Mother's Son, which won an Oregon Book Award for fiction. Her work has appeared in Tri-Quarterly, Narrative, the Arts and Letters Journal of Contemporary Culture, the Santa Monica Review, Pennsylvania Gazette, New York Post, and Portland Monthly, and she currently teaches in the University of Oregon's Creative Writing Program. We're fortunate to have Kai live in the KBOO studios with us now to talk about Weather Woman. Kai Emmons, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, Kai, I read that the idea for Weather Woman came to you years ago. You were growing up in New England, and the weather there can change suddenly. You imagine you could just look up at the sky and change it. Probably not an uncommon fantasy for kids, huh?
Yes, I think a lot of people, actually, I've discovered since talking about this, do have that fantasy. And I think it was particularly intense in New England because the weather was so changeable, and often not the weather I wanted at that particular moment.
No.
What comes to mind is, you know, Halloweens that were too cold and I had to wear a coat over my costume. Or another example is that I got married in the rain in late May.
I read about that.
And really did not want it to be raining.
And without giving away too much, is actually a scene in the book where the title character kind of changes that.
Yes.
Probably something you wish you had the power to do at
that
time.
Yes, exactly. So there have been a number of instances. Those stand out, but many instances where I really did want the weather to be different.
Now, you wrote two novels, as we mentioned, previous to Weather Woman. At what point did that childhood fantasy about affecting the weather turn into the new novel?
Well, that's hard to say. You know, I mean, there's always a kind of a mysterious process that whereby an idea kind of descends and develops the intensity that forces you to want to actually write it. But I'm sure that the dire weather that we've been having as a result of climate change certainly factored into it.
And most recently, of course, Hurricane Michael.
Hurricane
in Florida
Michael
is awful.
And, you know, the fires that we've had all
summer.
And, you know, for successive years. I mean, all the hurricanes that we had last year, Irma and Maria. And so, you know, of course, I had written the novel before those events, but there was a sort of a slow build to the intensity that we have now. And I thought the time is right.
Oh, yes. Well, I've seen some reviews describe Weather Woman as a form of magical realism, given the somewhat magical power given to the title character. Her name's Bronwyn Artair. I also see a connection, though, maybe I'm alone here, to comic book superheroes, especially the Marvel ones. They usually start out as very ordinary men and women, Spider-Man's an example, with ordinary problems who suddenly are blessed and cursed with these great powers, and the question's always how to use them for the common good or selfishly. Was that any kind of conscious influence?
That's a really good dichotomy to bring up, because I do, when I'm describing the novel, I do think of it as a realistic novel, but for that one small element. And the place I think it diverges from being a comic, like the comic book heroes, is that it doesn't culminate in a clash between good and evil.
Right. And I by no means did I mean to denigrate the book by comparing.
No.
Comic books are very high in my pantheon of literature.
And I actually was really thinking a lot about that. I thought, you know, is she going to come? Well, she does in some ways come across a certain amount of evil, but it's really her mentor who's encountering that evil. But mostly it's her kind of trying to decide what to do with this kind of responsibility that has been laid on her as a result of having this power. And it isn't, as you say, a comfortable thing necessarily. It has its pros and cons. You know, she can help out her friends, and perhaps she can help out the world, but, you know, at some cost always. Of course, there's always a cost.
Right? And there are some setbacks in there as she tries to let other people know about her power or use it for the common good rather than selfishly, like stopping the rain at a friend's wedding.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that interested me as I was writing it was this question of how credible she is to the people that she shares her, you know, the fact that she can do this with. And, you know, some people will never believe her, and other people believe her at the drop of a hat, and then they're you know, people along the spectrum in between. But it's definitely, you know, when you think about all of us as believers, we're all somewhere on the spectrum.
Yes. Now, let's talk about the big issue at the heart of the book, and that's climate change and its devastating effects. We went into that a little. You said this is the preeminent problem facing the world today, and certainly no argument from me there. But the book got its start with the character and the premise, not with any desire to write about climate change.
Well, I knew that climate change would figure into this, but it was, as you say, a character premise that came to me first, a what if. What if someone really had this capability? And I will confess that originally when I started writing it, I was writing it about a man, a weatherman.
Oh, interesting.
And at some point, somebody suggested to me that I should change it to a woman. And when that, it was immediately,
I have to ask why. Why did that click, that change in gender?
Because I realized there is something about the way we regard weather people, which is we sort of denigrate what they do or trivialize them. There are so many movies where they make
they're kind of the funny sidekick on every local news report, right?
Yeah, and I thought it would really kind of magnify the situation if this were a woman and she had this power. I just wanted the discrepancy. She's kind of a timid woman. She's smart, but she's, you know, hasn't been able to thrive in a PhD program at MIT. She just felt mocked and ridiculed. And so she's a woman that can be pushed around, I guess. And then it turns out that she has this incredible power. I just thought it would be more interesting. And then, of course, I'm always interested in writing about women. I don't even know what that other novel would have been. I have no idea. I don't think it would have been very good.
And Weather Woman's a much better title than Weather Man.
It is, yes, exactly.
Now, the book shows what must have been extensive research on climate change. How'd you go about that? I read a little bit about it. You started off by viewing this 24 DVD series on the Wonders of the Weather, was that
it? Yes, it was called The Wonders of the Weather, and it was supposed to be an introduction to meteorology. I mean, it was an introduction to meteorology done by this UCLA professor, Robert Fovell, but it was actually, given my rather limited scientific background, a lot of it was pretty challenging. But it did give me a real grounding in what was important in meteorology and sort of how to understand some of the basic concepts.
But that didn't go too much into climate change itself?
No, it wasn't dealing with climate change.
So you mentioned a glaciologist who was actually written about in a Rolling Stone article. We interviewed the writer a few weeks ago, Jeff Goodell.
The writer of the
Rolling Stone article,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, you're kidding.
But you said you actually went out on an expedition with him?
Yes. I had a very unusual experience in that he's the first person I ever got to know through Twitter, you know. And I saw that he was doing this research on dark snow in Greenland, the Dark Snow Project, and, the way dark snow absorbs the heat from the sun rather than reflecting it back, as white snow will. And so I became interested in that, and then we communicated over Twitter, and, you know, I told him what I was doing. And he said, well, you should come on this trip to Greenland with me, where I'm going to be the resident scientist on this tour.
Wow, what a generous offer.
Well, yeah. I mean, he wasn't paying for the trip.
Okay. Semi-generous.
It was very generous, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, it was an... he kind of agreed to be a little bit of a mentor to me, and we've since become friends and, you know, have stayed in close touch, even though he lives in Denmark. But his family lives here in Oregon. Some of his family does, at least.
And that gave you some of the background for, I should mention, the end of the book. They're in Siberia.
Yes.
And talking about the methane fields there, and the permafrost is starting to melt.
And I have to say, every time there's so much out about climate change now, and, you know, the recent report by the IPCC, and every time people mention the methane in the Arctic, I feel... I don't know what the word is, vindicated? I mean, I feel like, yes.
Now, the book, we should mention, too, because I, and you mentioned this before we got on, but I read about it, you're planning a sequel. So this isn't the end of Bronwyn Art Fair.
Yes.
And the sequel, the working title is Sinking Islands?
Sinking Islands.
Okay, so this book, it has, I can't say it's necessarily a positive ending, but it's a beautiful last sentence. So I was wondering about your particular views on, I've talked to, we did an interview from Between the Covers with a writer, William Volman, and he just came out with a two-volume book, Carbon Ideologies, on fossil fuels. And he is extremely negative about our hopes. And I we did one interview on the show last year about a guy who thought we would be the Earth would be uninhabitable by the year 2025. He just thinks it's going to be logarithmic in the acceleration of climate change and its effects. I was wondering how you felt and how that influenced the book.
Well, I'm certainly not enough of a scientist to give a date, and was very impressed when the IPCC report said by 2040 things were going to be pretty disastrous, because that's a lot earlier than many people have said. But I share their view that things are really disastrous. There are unpredictable feedback loops that are creating accelerating things, certainly in terms of the melting of the ice caps, but other things too. And I think there are unanticipated things that are happening.
What are those? Are those the intensified natural disasters like the hurricanes, tsunamis, typhoons?
And then the way that, climate change affects crops, and then the way when they're...
Hunger and water, food
hunger,
and water.
And then there's migration, right. And then there are, people get all up in arms about immigration. And and then people get... When there is scarcity, then people get warlike, or they get, they want to protect their own,
right.
And they're not generous. And so I think there are all these kinds of things that are not being, fully investigated or understood as we look at the whole picture. I mean, so yes, I think it's very bad. And I don't think when I began writing this book, I saw it as bleak as it is. Even, if you look at the sort of backup measures that are possible, the carbon capture and sequestration, those kinds of things, I mean, they're just not feasible to do at the levels that we need to do it. I mean, they're much too expensive, and we just don't have that developed technology yet.
I have a fairly long question here. We just have a few minutes.
I
should ask it, but maybe I'll try to condense it a little. I interviewed a writer, Todd Davies, last week, and her new book, fourth volume in a series of fantasy books called The History of Arcadia. And she makes a strong point that fairy tales and fantasy novels can be visionary literature, that they're not an escape from reality, as some people would view them. I definitely see that in your book. I wonder how you would address that. I mean, there's a big fantasy element in there. Of course, it takes place in a realistic world.
Yes.
But the premise is somewhat fantastical.
Yes, I see this as completely about our world. I don't see it as an escape in particular at all. It's, I've sort of magnified what I see as the capability of a person who's highly attuned to the natural world. We see her as a young child being very attuned, and that kind of attunement becomes this superpower, if you will. But I think I don't even totally see it as outside the realm of possibility. I don't know. I'm portraying myself in a slightly strange light now. But I mean, I do think that she's attuned in a way that a lot of the Native Americans have been attuned for centuries.
And there are stories of people who could make it rain if there's a drought. So,
absolutely. I've heard those stories.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're all fantasy yet.
Yes.
Well, that's my personal opinion.
Yes.
Now, Kyle, you're about to embark on sounds like an extremely rewarding and exhausting reading tour. You also did a tour in a van going to indie bookstores across the Northwest and talking with booksellers.
Yes, I did.
And I should ask, because we just have about a minute left, for our listeners in Portland and also Eugene, when are you going to be back here?
Oh, that's good. Yes, I'm going to be reading in Eugene on Wednesday after 4:30 at the Night Browsing Room on the U of O campus.
Okay, this Wednesday.
Yes. Uh-huh. I'm reading in Eugene at J. Michael's Bookstore on November 9th, which is a Friday. And then I'm reading at Powell's on Hawthorne on November 15th.
Okay, and that's at 7:30.
At 7:30, right. Okay. So those three. And yes, in between, I will be going back
traveling
east,
and, right.
You know, to Denver and Boulder, and then back east again. Makes no sense, but yes.
Well, Kai, thanks very much again for coming into KABU this evening.
Thank you. Lovely questions.
We've been talking with Kai Emmons, author of the new novel Weather Woman from Redhead Press. You can meet Kai here in Portland, as we mentioned, and get a signed copy of Weather Woman at Powell's on Hawthorne. That's Thursday, November 15th at 7:30. And you can find out more about Kai and her work at Kai Emmons Author, Kaiemmons author.com. This is Ken Jones for KABU's News in Depth.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KABU. Consider adding KABU to your will or add KABU as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KABU along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KABU to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kabu.fm to notify us of your plans.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st at 7:30 at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution gives one answer to the question, what happens when the community you need is not the community you have? Queer Core shows the development of the movement through the rise of artists who used radical queer identity to push back equally against gay assimilation and homophobic culture. The film features Bruce LaBruce, G.B. Jones, John Waters, Tom Jennings, Team Dresch, and many more. Again, that's the screening of Queer Core, How to Punk a Revolution, on Sunday, October 21st, 7:30, at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the